accession number 20939, reel 1.
Alec Clark, reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in a fishing town called Buckey, up on the Murray Firth coast in the northeast of Scotland.
Which year was this?
That was in the year 1920.
Did both your mother and father come from Buckey?
The same town. In fact, the village, there's a fishing village the east side of Buckey. It's all part of one town, but Portesi is the village. And they both come from the same village. And so when I came to look at my ancestors, it's easy to trace them.
What did your father do for a living?
A herring fisherman. And this on the wall, you'll see the fishing boat there of the Rahomi, BCK 62.
Did he own his own boat?
He came into ownership about the year... when I was a boy, he came into the ownership of it. And so, of course, when I left school, Buckey High School, I went to sea on a herring drifter from the hometown of Buckey, because there was no other jobs available at that time.
Did your father employ anybody?
Oh, there was 8 or 9 men, and the drifter, that was the crew. Sometimes it was even 10, but it was usually about 9 men, a crew, and... So there was the skipper, there was the mate, there was the share fisherman, and there was three paid men, was the engineer, the stoker and the cook. They were usually paid, but the other men depended on the share of the, depending how the results of the fishing. If they got a good fishing, they were well paid, but if there was no money, they got very little.
So what did most people prefer to do? Would they prefer to have a wage or to have a share?
Well, when the herring fishing was prosperous, they all wanted to earn that way. But of course, towards the end of the time of the herring fishing, it became rather difficult for the share fishermen, you know, to earn a living properly. So some of them preferred to get proper wages. But of course, it was only the engineer, the stoker and the cook had got regular wages. That was the setup that they had to put up with.
So when you were drifting,
yeah,
what were the catches like in the 30s?
Oh, the trouble was not so much with the catches as with the price that they got for the herring. See, the herring fishing prospered before the First World War, because there was unlimited market for the herring. But after Russia became communist, and then there was difficulty with the markets. So that was the problem. It wasn't so much that the amount of herring; it was the markets that were not there. The Russian market was finished. The German market was limited, and so the herring drifters had to catch a limited amount because of the markets. That was where the trouble lay.
You mean there had been a good market in Germany which disappeared?
Well, the Russian market was the big one, yes. Yes, there was a good one in Germany, but that continued. But the biggest one was the Russian. When the communists took over in 1917, that finished the herring fishing, really, because that market finished completely. That market was didn't exist anymore after the First World War.
But there were plenty of herring around?
Oh yes. There was no problem with the herring until the purse net. You see, that was the drift net fishing. Now, the Norwegians brought about the purse seine net, and that was what could take whole shoals of herring. And the shoals of herring almost became extinct. And so that's why they had to have quotas for herring. So the boats are only allowed, but the drift net fishing became obsolete with the purse net fishing, which came on the scene. That was in the 1960s and 70s. So it was a long time after the war, but that was what killed the herring stocks and also the mackerel.
So when you went out from Bucky in the 30s, what fish were you catching?
Oh, herring, just herring. Only herring, because they were herring drifters. That was what they specifically were built for, to catch herring. They could be adapted to other things, but it was all herring boats, mostly.
And how long would you go out for?
Oh, the herring fishermen went out for one night at a time. One night, and always came back in the next morning. And it was very, very seldom that they ever stayed out at sea. Because, you see, the herring had to be fresh. There was no means of, no cold storage. So if there was any herring, they had to get in to get the market. And they had to, that they remained fresh then. But if it was a day, if the herring was a day old, well, we would get the same value for it. So they had to be in every day. So it made it good compared with the trawling, where you went out for a fortnight, a week, maybe more. But the herring fishermen were in every day to port, as a rule.
What hour of the morning would you aim to get back
at? Well, depending on where the shoals were. If you're a long way off, say you were 70 miles off, that was a long way to get back into port, because the drifters went 8 to 9 knots. So depending on if you were close inshore, you could be in port in an hour or so's time. But if it was a long distance out, you had enough ado to get back into port, discharge your fish, and get off to sea again if it was a long way off, you see. But so depending where the shoals of herring were. Sometimes you fished on Stornoway, sometimes up at Lerwick, sometimes Orkney. And the best fishing of all was the Great Yarmouth fishing, Yarmouth and Lowestoft, October and November. That was by far the best herring fishing, because you were close inshore. It was not far out, and the herring, it's very sandy water down there, and that's the only place that the herring could take during the hours of daylight. You had to wait until the night time for the herring to be caught in the North Sea, in the deep water. But at Yarmouth, because of the sandy water, the herring could take during the day. So you could shoot your nets during the day and get a good catch of herring. That was a lovely herring fishing, the Yarmouth and Lowestoft.
What do you mean what do you mean by the use of the word take?
Well, they would be caught. The herring are caught by their gills and the meshes of the herring net. That's how the drift net works, you see. And normally you'd have to wait until night time, and darkness would make the nets invisible to the herring, and they would get caught. But you see, with the sandy water, it was so thick that the herring didn't see the nets, and they could be caught by their gills in the meshes of the net quite easily. So it's a very interesting. You see, I was born and brought up with a herring fishing, so that's why I knew such a lot about it. And it becomes part and parcel of your everyday life, you know.
And when you were fishing yourself, yeah, which waters did you personally fish in?
Oh, well, Lerwick, up in the Shetlands, Strawnsea in the Orkneys, Fraserburgh and Peterhead. But the only thing is, you see, now, if you're fishing from Fraserburgh and Peterhead, if you're far enough off, you could meet the boats from Lerwick and Strawnsea. You could go to the same waters, but it was a different place. You could get a better market, perhaps, in Fraserburgh and Peterhead, you see. So, depending how far offshore that the shoals were found, you had to go wherever the herring was found. Off the Fair Isle, in between Orkney and Shetland, there's the Fair Isle. There was fishing off of there. There was fishing at Stornoway, on the west coast, but the best fishing was always the Yarmouth fishing. That was before it was a lovely fish. Mind you, the weather was bad that time of year, and for the likes of myself, I was very seasick. That's why I had to give it up eventually. I suffer from seasickness. I was 3 years at the herring fishing. I was glad to give it up.
Which months of the year would the drifting take place?
Well, you would start the summer season in the month of May. May, June, July, depending on when, if the herring was still available. You see, May, June, July, about at least about 3 months, you see, for the herring fishing. And then, see, sometimes there was what you called a winter fishing. But I never saw much of that. I only saw one time we went to the Firth of Forth to a winter fishing, but it was very poor. There was very little herring. That was way back in the 1930s. We went on the Rahomie there, but it was a poor fishing. But it was only one winter.
So would it be the same shoals which were moving south? Or
no, no, I don't think so. No, there were the Yarmouth herring was a different kind of herring from the North Sea. I mean, off of Lerwick. And now you take Stornoway, the west coast. Sometimes there were lovely big herring off the west coast of Scotland. Over there. Now, the Yarmouth ones were smaller herring. And they were firmer and more solid. And there were a slight difference in the herring, because the Yarmouth ones would be smaller. And often on the west coast of Scotland, you got huge, lovely big herring. So that there was different shoals of herring, obviously.
And which were the best eating?
Oh, well, they were all very nice, really. I mean, I wouldn't say there was any difference in them, because the herring tastes the same, whether they're big ones or small ones. On the herring drifters, the fishermen, the cook, I was a cook, and you had fried herring every day, except Monday, when you had kippers. You'd fried herring every tea time. But of course, you got as many as you wanted, you know, you got to. And so the herring was part and parcel of your life, except on Monday. And see, you know, the boats didn't go out at the weekend, so there's no fresh herring for Monday. But you got from the fish salesman, you got a dozen kippers. So the men could have a couple of kippers for their tea on a Monday as they were after they'd gone out to sea.
But a kipper is a herring.
That's right, yeah, but you boil them. It's easy for the cook to boil kippers rather than to fry herring on the top of a stove, and it's a gale of wind. It's quite a thing to cook for 8 or 9 men on a little drifter. You know, you've been pitched and tossed about all over the place.
Would you get any other fish in the nets?
Oh, sometimes you get dogfish. God, I remember once in Stornoway. It was the end of the summer, and there wasn't much herring being landed. And we went across to the Isle of Hannah, off Loch Laxford, in the northwest of Scotland. And we got 150 cran, and they were in half of the nets. And the dogfish are like young sharks, you know. God, the amount of sharks, the amount of dogfish that we had. There was a section where the fish are kept, and when they picked the dogfish out of the nets, they threw them to the after end of the boat. And when I finished my coiling of the ropes and I went aft, I had to stomp through the dogfish to get into the galley to get the breakfast going. But that wasn't very often. But you'd get more dogfish on the west coast, and of course they would tear the nets. It was an awful job when you got a the nets would be torn by the herring, but if you got dogfish, they would go straight through, and they had to be mended. Sometimes you'd get whiting, sometimes you'd get mackerel. But you see, the herring fishing is what they call pelagic. They're the ones that swim to the surface. The other fish are demersal. The sea net and the trawl, they fish over the seabed. So that it's only the fish that swim to the surface that you get on the drift nets.
Was there any rivalry between the different ports?
Well, funnily enough, you know, some boats, for instance, say at Yarmouth, now some boats would go always to Lowestoft, some would go to Yarmouth, and they would stick to one port. Well, of course, it was good for the fish salesmen and the buyers. You got to know. I never fished out of Lowestoft. My father always fished out of Yarmouth, but some boats always went to Lowestoft. But that was just a difference. And then you see, the Fraserburgh men, they would prefer to fish out of Fraserburgh. The Peterhead men would fish out of Peterhead if they could. You'd only go to another port if the fishing was better somewhere else. You would go to that distant place, you see. But the fishermen prefer to be near home, if possible.
But was there any antagonism between the fishermen of different ports?
Oh, no. province. No. They were all making a living. The only, not antagonism, but you see, was a limited market. The boats that got in first with their catch and got their sample up to the market, they often got the best price. So there was always a race into port to get the market and get the best price, because there was always a market for what you call fresh herring. The rest would be cured and salted, so you wouldn't get so much. So if you could get in first, you could get the best price and you could get the top of the market. So there's always, that was the race then, to get into port, get your fish sold. And now, for instance, the time that I got, we had a big catch on the Rahomie, 150 cran. The dogfish took bites out of the herring. When the fish were being landed, the curers would be up on the quay and say, look, take those herring out. We don't want those herring got bites in them. And they would argue about the cost and the price. They said, well, we'll reduce the price if you don't do this, that and the other. So there was often a bit of conflict with the curers. The fishermen never thought they were getting enough for the herring. And the curers, they would want to reduce the price of the herring because it wasn't up to quality or standard. So there was plenty of rivalry between the fishermen and the curers. And you always thought the curers were cheating you. You know, that's what the fishermen thought. I don't think they were, really.
Would you ever have to stay the night ashore?
Oh, no, no, you always stayed on the boat. No, you never do that. I mean, you're there to earn a living. You couldn't do any other.
Did you ever have any contact with trawlmen going far afield?
Oh, just occasionally. Just, when you saw those hull and the Grimsby trawlers, and if you were close enough to them, you would say, how many boxes, you know, and they would tell you, 500 boxes or something like that, you know, whereas the Aberdeen trawlers, they would have 30 boxes or something like that. But there was always an admiration for these huge hull and Grimsby trawlers, where they're coming back from Bear Island, Spitsbergen, and the long way off. Always a great admiration for those men because of the bad weather and what they had to put up. Even Iceland was a good fishing place before the exclusion zone brought them out of Iceland.
So they'd be telling you how much they'd cost.
Yeah, that's right. That was a greeting on the way as they passed you by. You'd say, how many have you got, skipper? And they would tell you how many fish they got. But and of course, if you're in any proximity with a trawler, sometimes you get a fry of fish, you see, because the fishermen, it was a herring fishing, and you would have to be near to some trawler who was getting plaice and haddock and cod from the seabed. You might get a fry of fish, what they call a fry, on that basis, you know.
What's a fry?
About a quantity of fish, quantity of fresh fish. Maybe a fry is, the herring, you would put them on a string and take them home as a fry. A fry of fish is just a quantity for use, you know, for cooking. It's always a fry of fish.
You mean that the trawlers would pass cod over to you?
Oh, well, that would be very occasionally, because, you see, at sea, if it was rough, you couldn't. It was only if it was fine weather, and if you knew the trawlers. But in actual fact, the trawlers, we never saw the trawlers working very much on the herring fishing, because it was different grounds altogether.
Was there any danger in the drifting job?
Well, actually, the steam drifters were very good sea boats. They, because of the coal burning, they weren't economic. And of course, the motor boats became more popular. They were a bit smaller. But I remember at Great Yarmouth when one called the Olive Branch turned turtle, and the men were all lost. And of course, the reason for that is because it didn't have such a grip on the water. You know, the drifters were well down in the water. They were more solid in the water. And they were good sea boats, but the motor boats were more dangerous than the motor boats than the drifters. There's been more motor boats lost than drifters. Drifters were lost. And, there's always been tragedies amongst the fishing boats. In fact, in my hometown, there's a little chapel, and in this little chapel, there's the names of all the fishermen that have been lost, you know, down over a century. And, of course, when a whole crew are lost, that becomes well known publicly. But if there's only one or two fishermen, that doesn't make news, you see. But there's always men being lost. Ever since the time, since the men have been going to sea, there's always been men lost. And I remember my father, he was still at Great Yarmouth. And they were mooring up to the quay, and a man jumped ashore. But he missed his footing, fell into the water, and he was killed. That was just one incident I remember. So there was a lot of dangers connected with the sea. And men had to live, you know, the storms. Even today, with all the modern gear, it's still a dangerous life. Of course, the men take more risks, I think, nowadays.
Would you ever compete with foreign vessels?
The herring drifters, no, there's no competition from foreign ships, no. See, they had their own fishing grounds and their own methods and ways of fishing.
Where would you get your equipment from?
In my hometown of Bucky, you see, you buy your nets, your ropes, your buoys. It was all bought locally. But of course, that's all gone now. The herring fishing is a thing of the past. That doesn't exist anymore. But it was the herring fishing that brought a measure of prosperity to my hometown of Bucky. And those drifters were all built before the First World War. Very few were built after that time.
What about the workforce who were processing the fish ashore?
Well, my mother was a gutter. My mother left school at 15. She went to the gutting down to the Shetlands. And the women folks were part of the setup. They used to go where the fishermen were landing their fish so that they could gut the herring. The market for herring was cured herring in barrels, and that was bought by continental buyers. So the women had to be there. They worked in teams of three to gut the herring and pack them in barrels. So my mother was one of a group of three who used to gut the herring. And so it was necessary for that. That was the way of life. The men would catch the fish, the women would gut the herring, and they would be employed by the curers.
How did you like doing that?
Well, it was very hard work. Very hard work. And of course, most people, as they grew up, they determined that their children would never do that sort of thing. It's like the coal miners. You wouldn't do it unless you're born to it, used to it.
What were the worst aspects of the job?
Oh, long hours, hard work. I mean, there was no unions or trade unions or anything like that in those days. My mother, she went to 15, she left school at 15, went to the gutting. And a year or so after that, when she went to the gutting down in Yarmouth, somebody came round and asked her. She was supposed to be 18 and she was still only 17, but she wasn't supposed to be working, you know. But at that time, they were so glad to work. My mother earned £20 for the first year at the gutting, and she thought that was a fortune to her.
And would she just do the job in Bucky?
Oh, no, not in Bucky. No, the gutting wasn't in Bucky, it was a distance. For the first year, she went down to Baldersound, which was north of Lerwick in the Shetlands. She went after that to Fraserburgh. So they had to go where the herring were being cured. See, so it could be different places. But, of course, when they went to the Yarmouth and Lowestoft, they either went to one port or the other, and they stayed there for 6 weeks or 2 months, however long the herring fishing was. They stayed in Yarmouth for that period of time and then went back home again. There were special trains used to run them down to Lowestoft and Yarmouth, or they got a boat to take them to Orkney and Shetlands cargo passenger type of ferry.
So the women would be transported up and down the country?
Oh yes.
Would they continue doing that after they were married?
Oh yes, they depended on, oh yes they would, yeah, oh yeah. But of course, my mother didn't do that when we came along. She would, when some women would, if it was convenient for them. But once we had four of a family, my mother, she only did that in a single day, not when she was married. But some of the women would have done if the circumstances allowed it.
Now, you said you gave up the job because of seasick.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
What did you do after you gave up?
Well, you see, there was no work in Bucky at that time. None at all. I couldn't have got... So there was enough money at home for me to go to the Aberdeen Wireless College. And that's what I did. In January 1939, I went to the Aberdeen Wireless College to train as a wireless operator. There was some other men in my hometown had started this. And as I began to be interested in wireless, they thought this would be a good opportunity. So I went to Aberdeen, and of course I stayed in Diggs there. And in September 1939, of course, the war broke out, as you know. And however, I continued my studies there until I got my first certificate. In December 1939, I took my special PMG certificate. And of course, when the war broke out, they were anxious to get men at sea. Every ship had one operator, but they needed two or three. But if they got two, they could keep continuous watch. So that's what happened. So I went to sea. I got my special PMG. December 1939, and January 1940, I joined the Marconi Company in Glasgow, and I was appointed to my first ship, the City of Athens. And there was two operators, you see, and we kept continuous watch. Eventually, when they trained more men, they got three operators, see. But to begin with, the first number of ships on which I sailed was only two operators, see. And eventually, they got three when the men were trained in wireless telegraphy and the basics of watchkeeping, and they could do what was necessary.
What does PMG mean?
Postmaster General. Second PMG, that's what it's called, second class PMG certificate.
How did you feel when you heard the news that we declared war on Germany?
Well, we felt it was inevitable. You know, there was Chamberlain was going shuttling to and fro. In fact, before I went to the Wireless College, the local shipyard had Mackenzie's. My father was trying to get me a job ashore, and the foreman of the shipyard said, "Now look, if we get an order for a minesweeper, I might get a job as a carpenter at this local boatyard." And at that time, that was a year, 1938, you see, there was war preparations going on some time before the war was declared. Everybody, well, I think most people knew that something was going to happen with Hitler and all the things that were happening on the continent of Europe. So it wasn't altogether a surprise that war was declared. I think things had been building up for it for some time. So, we took it as, it's happened and there it is. I was in Aberdeen at the time. I remember the Evening Express, special editions of the Evening Express being published and going through the streets selling their newspapers about the war. Didn't make any difference to me as such.
Did the war affect you at first in Aberdeen?
No, we weren't affected in any way. No, it didn't make any difference. Not a bit.
Can you tell me about going to sea, first of all, please, in your first ship?
Oh, well, it was January 1940. I joined the City of Athens in Glasgow at the dock area. It was called Broomielaw. So I was the second operator. And from Glasgow, we sailed down the Clyde to Liverpool. And it was there we loaded general cargo for South Africa. And I remembered January 1940 because it was a very bad winter. It was my first time I'd been in Liverpool. And, of course, Liverpool was a very busy port at that time. Ships unloading and cargoes being discharged. And so, anyway, we loaded general cargo for South Africa. And of course, when we had loaded up, we went off in convoy out into the Atlantic. And after we'd gone a certain distance out into the Atlantic, we hived off from the convoy to go south. So we weren't a fast ship, but they must have reckoned it was safe enough for the ships to go on their own south. So we left the convoy and then we went south across the equator down to Cape Town. And I always remember